On Tech News Today, the EU says Europeans have the right to be forgotten on Google search, but they forgot about the right to be remembered. Plus, Apple wants to turn your iPhone into a credit card. TrueCrypt may be coming back from the crypt. And finally, a new theory about why Apple is buying Beats. And this one actually makes sense. All that and more coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, May 30th, 2014. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor this week is Natalie Morris, a contributor to NBC and co-founder of ReadQuick, a speed reading app for iOS. Welcome, Natalie.
Oops.
I'm muted. Thank you.
I thought you had laryngitis for a second there.
No, since I had been fooling around in our starts of the show, I muted myself so I wouldn't mess up our intro.
Oh, well.
I did that anyway.
Oh, well. Well,
I'm in a troublemaking mood.
Oh, well, you came to the right show because we have a lot of trouble coming ahead. And one of the pieces of trouble we have that just broke within the last hour is that, I guess inevitably, Jason, Google is going to shut down the Motomaker website. The Motomaker website was an innovative factory, essentially, that enabled you to customize a smartphone. In fact, this phone in my hands, this lovely piece of kit right here with the wood back, was my second Motomaker phone. There was some question as to whether Lenovo was going to continue the Motomaker site, whether they were going to expand it globally. But it looks like the Texas plant is going to be shut down. The 700 employees are going to be laid off. And it's the end of customized smartphones for now. Jason, are you depressed or do you not care?
No, of course I care, because I thought that the Motomaker kind of approach was an interesting approach. Was Motorola successful enough to kind of warrant the cost that had to have gone into turning these things around as quickly as possible? Obviously not. I mean, if in the transition it would have been a big money maker and would have made financial sense, then I'm sure they would have probably stuck with it. But I had my doubts. I honestly thought that this was going to happen inevitably.
Yeah.
And it happened sooner than I thought. But
yeah.
I'm not surprised, but I'm a little disappointed. They were doing something different with that, and I thought that was kind of cool.
It was definitely the Google way. I talked to a senior Moto X engineer designer. On the team that built the original Moto X. And he said that the biggest difference between going from regular Motorola to the Google version of Motorola was that in these meetings where they toss ideas out there on the table, Google banned any discussion of that's too expensive to do. They basically said, don't worry about the money. Let's just do the best thing possible. And that's how the Motomaker site came into existence. Google said, don't worry about how much it costs. Don't worry if we're going to be losing money on these phones. Let's do something really killer. And that's not going to happen at Lenovo, probably. They're in it to make a profit on the phones themselves.
Yeah, and I'll be very curious to see what other changes happen, because, you know, as we've talked about plenty of times, and I know I've talked about on All About Android, Motorola has done a lot of things right since it was acquired and by Google, and actually that kind of influence started to seep into the inner workings of Motorola. I really hope they stick close to kind of their design approach. I really hope that they stick close to their dedication to a somewhat less like a bloated form of Android. But the fact that they're closing down one of the key pieces of that, suddenly I have my doubts.
Yeah,
and we'll see where it ends up.
But they're just really closing it as its own thing, because The Verge was reporting that they would still offer the customization service, but it's not clear how it will work with manufacturing being moved overseas. So it may still be a component of their existing product, but they just won't tout it as like such a big differentiation.
Well, and a quick turnaround thing too, because that was a big part of it.
Yep.
It's like customize it; you'll get it in 4 days, and that's obviously that's going to be a lot more difficult, if not impossible, moving overseas.
Absolutely,
right? But you can do this kind of thing with Snapfish. I see all the moms in the mom community have the iPhone cases with their kids on the background that they just made themselves. It doesn't matter what the phone is if you really just want the back to look like something different, right? So it's just not the business model they think it was, or it's just too easy for hacks, I guess you'd even call a Snapfish case a hack.
Well, speaking on behalf of the dad community, I'm really going to miss the Motomaker site. Let's get into more serious news. We told you in a past episode that Google was required by the European Union to let people be forgotten on the Google search engine. Google complied today by offering a web page where people can submit URLs they want Google to delete from their search engine index. Google will review each and every submission on a case-by-case basis and decide what to keep and what to delete from just the European versions of Google search. Rolf Winkler is covering the story for the Wall Street Journal, and he joins us now. Welcome, Rolf.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Before we get into the politics and ethics of the right to be forgotten, can you give us some details about this new online form that Google put up? Is it similar, for example, to the copyright takedown forms?
Well, I can tell you, let me, by the way, in the conversation you guys just had, we, the Journal, actually broke the news that, Google is closing down that plant in Texas. The customizations are not going away, was what I was told. I broke that news. I spoke to Motorola's president. The customizations aren't going away. They're going to be happen at other facilities around the world where they're going to continue to make the Moto X. And we can talk about that in, more detail later. But again, on the right to be forgotten, yes, there is this website. And in effect, you can fill out, you know, it says, hey, put in your name, contact email address, and links associated with what your links associated with your name that you want removed. And it, you know, it has you fill in the URL, as many as you want. And by the way, to prevent fraudulent removal requests, you have to attach a legible copy of a document that verifies your identity. That's actually a little interesting. That is the part of the website that has already changed this morning, it appears. Google originally, when I was looking at the language of the website last night, it asked for a photo ID. Now it's saying, and I think some folks in I believe it's Germany, said that that's not okay. You can't require photo identification. And I don't know why. We've got to go back and study this, but they appear to have changed how they'll verify the identity here, which sort of gets to the, this is all really, you know, a moving target.
Yeah,
Google is sort of learning this as it goes, this whole process.
Yeah, and I'd imagine that the reason that Germany is against the photo ID thing is the same reason they're against the Google Street view cars and all the rest. They have a particular German view of privacy, apparently. But this is an interesting sort of, it kind of puts the brakes on people overusing this feature, I would imagine, if you have to give and have real identity. I don't know what sort of identity they're going to end up with in the absence of a photo ID system, but there was some speculation flying around on the social networks today that the photo ID system was a way to reduce the number of people stepping forward to do this. But again, there has to be real identity, right? Because this could easily be abused and could probably even be abused with good identity. What do you think about that, Rolf?
Google did say in the original language on the site that they receive fraudulent requests often. Was the word. So yes, I think that's something they're going to have to deal with. More important, this is just, I mean, what's most interesting about this is how they're going to have to learn as they go here. It's funny in a way that the Europeans have sort of put Google in this position of having to act as a censor. And in one sense, the Europeans are very unhappy with Google, with all of the power that it has accumulated for itself. On the other hand, they've just decided, all right, Google, you will now have to sit in judgment on whether certain links have to be taken down or not. In the past, the way Google handled this is they had more or less, when they got a request, they would kick it back to the online publisher, whoever they were linking to. They'd say to the person who's complaining, you know, don't talk to us, go talk to the newspaper that published that story. And if they take it down, well, then it'll eventually be reflected in Google search results. Now, people will be, of course, coming to Google saying, hey, remove the link to that. And Google will have to make a decision. And it's fraught how they're going to come to those decisions.
Well, they won't be able to actually remove the link or whatever content is up there. There were a few cases this morning in the Times even that, like, a woman in France wanted her daughter's half-naked pictures taken down. So those pictures will still live. They just won't show up in any Google search results. So, you know, Google is going to have to make a judgment call then on what they think is, that's just your fault, you put it on the internet too bad, and what is not your fault. For instance, the other man in the Times this morning who was falsely accused of being in a video where he was not paying, he was stiffing his cab the fair. It wasn't him. This guy was overseas. And then it became like every time you searched his name, people thought he was this cheap guy and people were sending him hate mail. And he was like, this is ruining my digital life. I don't want it up there anymore. He had a legitimate claim. But whereas the woman whose daughter put naked pictures up of herself, that's kind of her fault. Google shouldn't be responsible for that. So how are they going to make a judgment call?
It's going to be interesting. Now, one of the things they do say on the website, I'll read this to you. They say, when evaluating your request to take a link down from Google to something, we will look at whether the results include outdated information about you, as well as whether there's a public interest in the information. For example, information about financial scams, professional malpractice, criminal convictions, or public conduct of government officials. In other words, there are things that Google cares very deeply about. The right to know, people's right to see information. Of course, this is what its business is built on. And they are going to find ways to keep information up there if they feel it's important for the public's right to know.
And that's the other part of this that really bothers me, which is that what the European Union is demanding that Google do is increasingly make Google search inaccurate. In other words, the information is still on the internet, and they're asking Google to lie to European users and basically imply that the information is not there. And this is really problematic, and it raises another question, which is that if you imagine they've already got thousands of requests in for removals, assuming that a large number of those requests are granted and the links are removed, and you imagine this happening over time as more and more information is removed, it seems to me that European users, at least the technical users, are just going to route around the European sites and just go straight to the U.S. version of Google. Is that something that they'll be able to do?
It's a very good point, Mike. We don't really know just yet, but my guess would be, look, Google will probably try to remove links in the smallest geographic area where they are required to do so. In other words, as a law professor put it to me, yes, you may end up having a sort of balkanized internet where results are available in some places, but not available in others. So are journalists in Europe going to have to VPN around the web results that are available in their own country in order to see that some politician committed some crime, but they need to see it via the United States version of Google versus the Spanish version of Google or whatever? That would be very interesting to see is how exactly Google enforces these link removal requests. That's something to pay attention to.
And we're kind of pretending that we're in a one search engine internet, but we're not. So this will implicate the other search engines as well. And they'll have to comply with these laws, whatever are said. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so this is a fascinating issue. I recommend that everyone read Rolf Winkler's piece in the Wall Street Journal. Also, take a look at Jeff Jarvis's piece called "The Right to Remember." Damn it, I think is the headline. So that was an impassioned opposition to this whole policy. But before we let you go, Rolf Winkler, I want to go back to the Moto X Motomaker scoop. I apologize for not crediting you with breaking the news. I saw it on Twitter right before the show started, and I didn't really find out where it came from. But I would imagine that Lenovo, of course, is a Chinese company. The Chinese are better than anybody at very fast manufacturing and flexible manufacturing. So it seems kind of it seems like a reasonable assumption that the Motomaker idea is just going to be moved to China. But we haven't heard anything about that, right? Because we're only hearing about the Google part, which is closing the Texas plant. We haven't heard about the Lenovo part. And by the way, does Lenovo own Motorola Mobility yet? Or this is not a done deal yet, is it?
Not a done deal. It's something they anticipate will close by the end of this year. And you're right. We really don't know what the strategy is going to be after that deal closes. Now, for the moment, Motorola is sticking to what it calls its value strategy, which means, you know, you see devices like Moto X having its price cut significantly, Moto G, the new Moto coming out at prices that are, you know, retail off contract way below where comparable devices are. And the goal is to try and, at the expense of profit margins, the customer. I'm told are going to continue at plants where Moto X will continue to be made, not getting rid of the device. And I'm told by Motorola's president that they're planning a quote successor device to Moto X that'll be made in Brazil.
And that's, I think we've heard about that in rumors. I think they're currently calling it the Moto X Plus One or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's some title like that, but inevitably there will be a successor, I imagine. Rolf Winkler, thank you so much for joining us and talking about both of these stories, and congratulations on your scoop on the Motomaker site. That is bad news, but somebody's got to deliver it.
Thanks so much, Mike.
All right, thanks again. You can find Rolf Winkler at WSJ.com and on Twitter at Rolf Winkler. Apple is talking to retail store chains about an Apple mobile payment system. 9to5 Mac's Mark Gurman reports that the payment service would enable iPhone users to buy things in retail stores using their iPhones, kind of like credit cards, and the payment would be processed through their existing iTunes accounts. Mark Gurman is joining us on the show today to tell us more. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
So glad you're here. Now, Apple brags about having 800 million iTunes accounts that have credit cards associated with them, which I think is some kind of record. I think they have more than just about anybody. What took them so long to get around to doing this? It seems like kind of an obvious thing. You have all these customers, you have all these credit cards. Why not just flip a switch and have everybody using their iPhones as credit cards? It's not that simple, is it?
No, it's not that simple. In terms of different payment companies in the past, there's been lots of companies playing in this field. There's a company called Venmo, which focuses on sending a mobile payment from one person to another. There's Square, and they have their register system. There's PayPal. There's also been Google Wallet, which is sort of the area that Apple wants to play in. So the thing with Google Wallet, it didn't really catch on because of the technology and because of the partnerships. So what Apple's doing is they're starting early. And they're in a phase of development where they're going to payment companies, which has been previously reported. And now, as I reported yesterday, they're going to retail stores to try to see if they would use an Apple mobile payment service. And like you said, the way it would work is the phone would be a substitute for a credit card, and it would use the credit card on file with your iTunes account in order to authenticate a purchase in a store. So using your iPhone to pay for physical items in retail stores. And they've been talking to luxury brands, clothing brands, and brands of that spectrum about this.
Now, I've been writing about this issue over the last couple of years. I've probably written a dozen articles around this whole issue of Apple getting into the sort of mobile wallet business. It's a fascinating area because Apple has so many of the right parts. They have all those credit cards. They have fingerprint sensors in their phones now. They have iBeacon, which is an indoor location system that can do all kinds of magic stuff in retail outlets. And what they don't have yet is the buy-in by the retailers. But I have been predicting for some time that Apple wants to remake the whole experience of buying things in brick-and-mortar stores to be like the Apple Store, where there is no cash register. There is no waiting in line at some cash register. When you want to buy something, you find somebody in a blue T-shirt, and they just, you know, process the payment right there, and you do it from your phone, and that could all happen through iBeacon and through these other features that they have to offer. It seems to me that retailers are probably going to play ball with Apple on this because Apple customers are the kind of people who spend lots of money on luxury goods.
That's absolutely correct. Exactly what you said about wanting to move to that Apple Store model. So in addition to talking about mobile payments in general, Apple is also trying to court many different retail companies and chains to adopt iBeacons and other practices that they use in their Apple retail stores. And you're exactly right about Apple's customer base. They have over 500 million iPhones sold and probably nearing 100 million iPhones with Touch ID fingerprint scanners. And they're going to be rolling out Touch ID to more devices over the next year or two. So it's a big market, Apple's customer base, combined with those credit cards. And like you said, that's the most credit cards that any company has on file for their customer base. So I think this is big deal.
But like Mike had pointed out, this is more of a challenge of convincing the retailers than it is using the technology, because the technology is there. Maybe that's where the hire of Angela Ahrens came in. Do you think that she had relationships with these high-end retailers and she can sway them to give this a shot?
Absolutely. Yeah, like you said, the technology is there, but the partnerships are not. Angela Ahrens, I reported a couple weeks ago, is involved with the mobile payments plans from Apple, and she wants to revamp Apple's own stores with mobile payments. And yeah, she certainly does have partnerships and experience and knowledge of these luxury brands. So she's involved in that. And also There's a few other people involved. Eddie Q is officially in charge of the project. He's head of iTunes and iCloud and all those other Apple services and software like iLife and iWork. Jennifer Bailey, who was the former online stores chief who basically created the online store with Eddie Q over a decade ago, is running the project. And they've also hired a few people from the payments world, such as someone who ran mobile e-commerce practices for JP Morgan Chase Bank and someone who was a top executive for mobile payments at Visa. So they've clearly got the experience there to make this happen. And I think we'll see something roll out in the next year or two.
But this is a crowded space. We've seen a lot of attempts at this kind of mobile payments. We see we can pay with PayPal at Home Depot. I can pay with Square at my local coffee shop. What are the pain points from keeping any of these from succeeding where Apple thinks it can overcome them?
Well, the first big thing that Apple has that the others don't is the integrated ecosystem of the hardware, software, and services. They have the whole plate, everything there that is necessary on the technology front. They have the credit cards already integrated, so that will not require any customer setup. So it's going to be very seamless. Another thing they have, which is what I believe is stopping everyone, is the negotiation prowess, the ability to go into an existing market and get everyone on board to work with them on these products. So they will need the support from retailers, not just Home Depot, not just the local coffee shop, but these large chains that exist all over the world in order to actually revolutionize payments. Apple doesn't come up with an idea and then execute it in a small way. They come up with an idea and execute it in a big way. So, you know, paying with PayPal at Home Depot, PayPal is a big company, but it's not something that's caught on. Like, I didn't even know that Home Depot, you can pay with PayPal. So the way Apple's going to do it, they're going to go big, and that's through the partnerships that they have. One of the issues that some of the retailers were describing to me was that the standard for payment processing and the way transactions are handled, I mean, it's different from store to store and certainly from chain to chain. So Apple has to certainly, you know, strike deals and, you know, make it so there is a standard that the iOS and iPhone could integrate into to conduct the mobile payments.
I believed for a long time that although those of us who are gadget fans and at least occasional Apple buyers, we tend to look at, you know, what's the next iPhone? Are they going to continue being successful with the iPad? Are they going to come out with a TV? But I really think that it's just a matter of time before mobile payments is going to be at least half of Google's of Apple's revenue or more. This is such a huge market. I've seen estimates that in just Europe alone, it's a $1 trillion a year business if somebody could sort of dominate it. And I think I agree with you. I think Apple's in a better position to dominate this than any other company for the reasons you specified. And it'll be interesting to see what they're going to announce on Monday. And speaking of what they're going to announce on Monday, Mark Gurman, let me put you on the spot and ask you if you think that Apple is going to announce an iWatch on Monday. What do you think?
Before I answer that, I just want to clarify that it's very unlikely that they'll talk about mobile payments on Monday. So that's not something in store for next week, just because I reported it yesterday. In terms of the iWatch, yeah, I read or heard about your story where you believe the iWatch will be announced on Monday. And part of your reasoning is because of Samsung's event, right, last week?
To be clear, that wasn't an article. That wasn't a column. It was just I was just thinking without a filter on my blog on Google Plus. So that's not an official thing, but what I said was that the timing of Samsung's announcement around their medical smartwatch made me think maybe they know something about what Apple's going to announce on Monday, because of course we know that whatever Apple announces is going to have health related attributes, most likely, because they've hired so many health related people. They've already put so much effort into medical-related sensors. And so I thought, well, maybe Samsung knows something and they're trying to get some mind share before Apple takes over the mind share on Monday. I was just thinking out loud. But based on all the other things we know, there's lots of solid and not-so-solid facts and rumors and stuff floating around. I think I think you would agree that it's very, very likely that Apple will come out with an iWatch or a smartwatch at some point. We just don't know when. And so the question, I guess, is what do you think the chances are that when will be Monday?
It's a good question. Okay, so they'll talk about HealthBook, which is the health-infused software and some Bluetooth improvements for iOS 8 and their iOS devices. Will they announce the watch on Monday? You know, that's it's a really tough one. I would like them to. I just don't think it would happen. I really don't. Will it be announced by the end of this year? I think that's very likely. Monday? I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't know. I don't want to
say. We would all like them to. We're tired of speculating.
Yeah, that would be nice. I mean, I know there will be hardware. Yep. I just don't think it will be the watch.
Yeah.
Maybe by August, September-ish.
The thing that makes me think that they just might announce it is the fact that developers are going to be that's the attribute that's going to make this platform fly. Because as we saw with the iPhone was kind of like, it was pretty cool. It was fairly novel. But until they came out with the App Store and the app ecosystem, it wasn't the killer platform that it is now. And the iWatch is, I think, even more like that.
Right, but you have to think about these Apple products as a long series of development. So they'll have this list of features and their ideal iWatch, and it could be like a 10-year execution plan. So, you know, who knows if they're going to make it a platform from day one or from day 1,000. So perhaps WWDC 2015 or WWDC 2016 is when we'll hear about turning the iWatch into a platform. With these health devices and these wearable devices with these miniaturized components, they need to start small and build up over time. So I don't know. I think we're a little too soon on that.
Yeah, could be.
Well, we've had so many, you know, smartwatch announcements just in the last few weeks. And I can see this over and over in the chat room. People are like, yawn, we're sick of this. Just tell us what you got.
Yeah.
So they don't have much longer to hold our attention. We're just going to stop caring if we haven't already, like all 1,000 or so people in the chat room do.
I mean, I was at the Code conference and Eddie Q, head of services at Apple, was talking about future products. And he said that over the next or the rest of the year, their product pipeline is the best that he's seen in 25 years. And that is an extraordinarily bold statement.
Is it really? Is that a bold statement? I mean, don't products always get better?
It depends how you look at it. I mean, if you're going to be logical about it, and I 100% agree with that sentiment, that of course that this year's products are going to be better than last just by virtue of technology advancing. But, you know, Apple's customer base, the people are thinking, wow, 25 years, best products in 25 years. That's another way that people are looking at it. And the way Apple does its marketing and PR statements. And of course, the whole thing is like, you know, Eddie was probably planned from the beginning to say that. Yeah. So they know how people read their statements. So I think that they wouldn't say that unless they really did have something up their sleeves.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark Gurman, for coming on Tech News today again. I really appreciate it. And nice scoop there as always.
Appreciate it. Take care.
All right. Find Mark Gurman's scoops at 9to5mac.com. You can also, write from 9to5 Google as well, right?
Yeah, sometimes.
Occasionally.
I focus on 9to5Mac.
Yeah. Maybe. So check out 9to5Mac, occasionally 9to5 Google, or you can just look at everything he writes by going to Twitter and finding him at Mark Gurman, G-U-R-M-A-N. Can't spell today. Thanks again, Mark. Well, we told you yesterday about the sudden and mysterious demise of TrueCrypt, an open source encryption application. Visitors to the TrueCrypt website since Wednesday have been redirected to a SourceForge page advising users to stop using the product because of, quote, unfixed security issues, unquote. Well, it turns out that the anonymous volunteer developers of TrueCrypt just got tired of doing it, apparently, and made a hasty, if awkward, exit. But now a group of other security experts are planning to develop a fork of TrueCrypt and make it a going concern again if they can work out the legal rights to the code, and we will keep you posted on that story. Samsung and AT&T unveiled a rugged version of Samsung's top phone called the Samsung Galaxy S5 Active. The phone is shock, dust, and water resistant and has a convenience key on the phone's spine to launch outdoor-oriented apps. Apparently, you can even take photos underwater. And it's not really clear, Jason Howell, how rugged this really is. I mean, the Galaxy S5, the regular version, is really rugged and dustproof and water resistant and all that kind of stuff. It's not clear how much of this is cosmetic and how much of it is just really super ruggedized. The best part, though, I think you'll agree, it comes in camo.
Yeah, and if that's the only differentiator. Well, it also has the, I guess the S5 does have the hardware buttons as well, but... yeah, I'm not really. I have not taken a close look at the Active. I don't know. How did the S4 Active do in comparison to the S5 and or the S4? And you're right, the S4 already kind of has that kind of waterproof ability here. So differentiating this from that,
I think it depends on the depth. That's how they measure these things.
Yeah,
like
maybe this. Maybe you can scuba dive
this,
this
many
one.
Meters and freeze proof up down to this type of this level of coldness. So mm-hmm.
yeah, you can.
I don't know.
You can hit a.
You'll have to really test this one on the road.
Yeah, you can hit an Apple user across the head repeatedly without shattering the screen. It's really a great screen. It's not for sissies. Interestingly, I'm hearing that there was originally an underwater mode for the camera app for this device, which they removed before they shipped it. I don't know how legit that information is, but that is something I definitely want. I want to be able to take pictures underwater with my phone. I know that Sony has phones
like that.
Do you have
like a cause for that often?
No.
You do a lot of scuba diving?
No, I just secretly want to live a lifestyle that enables that. I don't actually, it's like owning an SUV. You own an SUV not because you actually go across the countryside and go through all this, you know, off-road driving. It's because you just want to. You want to be able to do
it's
it.
It's like if you
do.
Build it, they will come. If I have the phone, the lifestyle will come.
Yeah. I also want to
it can be like a midlife crisis kind of phone. Like instead of getting a Porsche, you get one of these.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Both the S5 and the S5 Active are IP67, which is basically dust and water resistant. So if this is the Active and it's... Yeah, I'm having a hard time understanding what the difference is here.
There's a rubber bumper around the outside.
There you go.
Yeah, so what are you going to do? Hey, whatever sells the phone.
Yeah, maybe it's an impact thing, right? Like you can drop it and this one won't break. The S5 might break.
And by the way, this is an exclusive to AT&T. Yeah. So... You know, there you go. Well, Apple's...
I get it, though. How many times do you see people with the... People can tend to be very hardy about their screens. They use them even after they've broken for so long. So the appeal of having a break-proof screen is big.
Yep. And we'll see what Apple does with Sapphire in that regard. Supposedly, that's going to be a much better improvement over Gorilla Glass. Well, speaking of Apple, Apple's acquisition of Beats Electronics has a lot of people scratching their heads, and a lot of people are saying, Mike, for the love of God, don't talk about this again. It's boring. It's a boring story. Why would Apple acquire a company that makes mediocre headphones and a streaming music service hardly anybody uses? Well, Michael Vakulenko, I hope I pronounce your name right, Michael Vakulenko, wrote a piece that was posted on the Medium site yesterday that has some really interesting ideas about Beats, the Beats music service, and the business model behind it. So welcome to you, Michael.
Hi there. Thanks for inviting me.
Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Almost.
Okay. Apologize for mispronouncing it to the extent that I did. Now, you wrote that to understand Beats, you need to understand what you call the Lady Gaga business model, which you described as the poster child of the economics of the new digital era. So what is the Lady Gaga business model?
Right. So first of all, this particular post is just a sample of a much deeper case study we're doing on digital business models, really. And it's a really good example of how you need to look beyond current products and see what companies may become in the future by looking at how they leverage content, platform economics, or economics of co-creation to drive their core business. We see many examples of companies doing that in many different verticals, and Apple move to acquire Beats, really yet another good example in this direction. So how Gaga is linked to that? Gaga is not only very successful music artist, it's very successful business. And Gaga is a business really did many things that were never done before. And this is very, you know, starts with very clever use of social media to create communities of fans. But looking at all the research around Gaga business, it's clear that Gaga is doing very good business around selling everything except music. And this is was said clearly by Troy Carter, who is ex-manager of Lady Gaga, who said that really music sells everything except music.
Exactly.
So that brings us to Beats. Yes, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, so just to capture this in economic terms, economics, classical economics, if you will, is based on the concept of supply and demand. And I think everybody understands this, where you have a limited supply and you have demand, which is high or low or whatever. And where those two points meet, that's the price that's set for any sort of goods or services. In the case of digital music and digital downloadable content, supply is an entirely different thing. There is no scarcity, unless it's artificially created, but there's no scarcity in digital songs. If you post a song, it's one person can download it or a billion people can download it. It doesn't matter. There's no scarcity in the music. And therefore, ultimately, the price, the natural price for downloadable music is zero. And so the Lady Gaga business model, which Jimmy Iovine is very much aware of and into, and one of the reasons why, as I understand it, he launched Beats Music, is that it's Beats becomes a place where artists can take this thing that's essentially worthless. In fact, Lady Gaga herself said that her songs are not worth 99 cents. And if you're not a Lady Gaga fan, maybe you agree with that. But the whole point of this is to take something that has no scarcity, this is economic terms again, and you attach it to things that do have scarcity, things like concert tickets, things like Beats headphones, lots of products that do follow the scarcity model and therefore are worth a lot of money. And that's the whole point of Beats Music. Is that how you understand it?
Exactly. And this is actually not the new model. If you look at what Amazon is doing with content, you have many elements of that being implemented very successfully already. Of course, Amazon's core business is different from the one of Apple. And Amazon uses content to get people on board of Amazon services and keep them engaged, mostly. Apple actually is doing the same thing with apps and music on iTunes as well. Even though App Store by itself is very big business, even though iTunes is very big business, Apple is not making profit or very small profit on content. And Apple executives were saying that on several occasions that, for example, App Store is being run just above the break-even.
I've heard that Apple makes one penny on every song on average. I read that somewhere. I don't know if that's the current number, but I think a few years ago they were making they would sell it for 99 cents and it cost them 98 cents to provide that.
It's a low margin business. And if you compare that to the margins they're having on iPhones, you know, the business model is going to be clear. Use the low margin goods to drive sales of the high margin goods. And this is what they exactly do.
You mentioned here that they also might want to make a business model that the musicians can control a bit better. And they've done that sort of before, but they weren't successful. Why do you think they haven't been successful before? And what do you think that Beats will offer them to succeed now?
Well, it's all about people who are running Beats Music and Beats. And you need to look at history of people like Ian Rogers, for example, who one of the key people there, and Jimmy Iovine himself is a very experienced guy in terms of innovating in music and has huge experience from Lady Gaga and other artists. So they understand this new economics very, very well. What they're trying to do now is to replicate that at scale, at huge scale, not just work with, you know, specific artists, but create a platform that will enable artists to create businesses and through that drive business of Apple.
So as I understand it, the model we're looking at and the issue that we're talking about right now is that to a certain extent, the acquisition of Beats Electronics for Apple is not about selling headphones and it's not about using their technology behind the music service. It's about once again reinventing the business model for downloadable content. And what they did was they hired Jimmy Iovine, who's I can't think of another person who's more expert and experienced at this reinvented business model, and also getting on board with Beats Music, which is already on the path to enabling this business model. Is that your understanding?
Correct. So it's all about what Beats married to Apple may become in the future and how that can extend and enhance the current business of Apple, which is more or less focused on devices. This is where the company makes most of their money and almost all of their profits.
Well, Michael Vakalenko, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today. It was a fascinating article. I really appreciate it. And you're bringing some light to a pretty confusing acquisition, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. You can find Michael at on Twitter, and I'm going to spell that at M-V-A-K-U-L-E-N-K-O, and also at visionmobile.com. Well, a new glassware app called Recallable provides Google Now-like contextual notifications for you, but with the ability to harvest personal data from email services that are not Gmail. It also looks at your calendar, activity, and location to guide you through the day, and then to throw little suggestions and ideas and facts and information into your eyeball. Pour it right into your right eye, as Google Glass is wont to do. Now, the Recallable app is already available for Pebble, Sony Smartwatch 2, and Samsung's Gear Fit and Gear 2 devices. It's a wearable application. I've used the former iPhone app. I don't know if you have, Jason, but it was called Recall. And it was this. They were doing Google Now type stuff long before Google ever launched Google Now. Have you ever used this app?
I never have, no. No, I mean, I'm pretty clueless when it comes to iOS, to be honest. So, yeah, it looks very interesting, and it seems like Glass is kind of the perfect place for an app this contextual to kind of land on.
Yeah, I mean, I was blown. They were the first company that I've ever encountered that used location-based reminders. So I think as long ago as probably, I don't know, I'm probably going to mess this up, but like 2009 or something like that, they had a setting where you could be at the dry cleaners and, you know, you just open the app and say, you know what, next time I'm anywhere near the dry cleaners, remind me to pick up my dry cleaning. And then you'd forget about it. And then a week later, you'd be driving down the street and pop up and say, hey, the dry cleaners is right there. Go pick up your laundry. That was amazing back then. Nowadays, with Google Now, that sort of thing, and other apps that are out there and services, that sort of thing is less shocking. But you know, this is exactly the kind of thing you'd want in Google Glass, because you really want that little sort of assistant whispering in your ear and pouring information into your eye, guiding you through your day.
And then they'll put it in the smart car, and then you'll think you're going home, but it'll turn into the dry cleaners because it will remind you, remember, we're going here.
That's right.
And then you won't have any say.
It'll be like, don't worry, we have time. Your dinner is not for another half an hour, so it's cool.
Then it talks to your bank account and says, oh, actually, you've overdrawn, so you can't afford your dry cleaning, so we're going to pull out. Never mind.
Or the smart shirts will simply summon the automatic car. And then
right.
It's going to be a crazy world. Well, that is the
Or it'll be some kind of Jetsons car that just washes you and your clothes while you're inside and brushes your teeth and feeds you.
As long as it rolls you out of bed like Wally. Yeah. As long as it flies and fits into a briefcase, I will love it. Well, that's the tech news today. Natalie Morris, I want to thank you for being here all week. You were here Friday. You were here Tuesday through Friday. And I really appreciate it. It's been a great week. Thanks to you being our guest co-anchor.
It's been fun. I've learned a lot.
So have I. It's been a really wild, jam-packed week for news. Yeah. And next week's going to be wild, too, because of WWDC. Well, thanks again for being on this week.
Thank you, Natalie.
You're welcome. See you guys again soon.
All right. Well, Monday's live tech news today begins at 8:30 a.m. Pacific, because we're covering Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference keynote starting at 9:30 a.m. Pacific. You can join Leo Laporte, Sarah Lane, Alex Lindsay, and me for our special coverage of the keynote at live.twit.tv, and we invite you to do that. Also, I'll be hosting Twit, the big show, on Sunday, so make sure you tune in for that. Should be fun. And if you want to make sure you never miss an episode of Tech News Today, just subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. And we want to hear from you. Send us an email at tnt@twit.tv. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News, tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific. We'll see you either bright or early Monday morning for Tech News Today. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks again.